obligations of citizenship enjoin upon each American the duty not to pretend not to know when cruelty is visited on others in our name and with our support. The obligations of citizenship require us, therefore, to take back our ideals and become, once again, a secular republic rather than a faith-based empire.
That's Edward Said, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Edward Said on U.S. interventions in the Middle East. The current occupant of the White House has said, "The Middle East is a troubled place. There are a lot of bad things happening in that part of the world." Indeed, but why is it a troubled place, and why are bad things happening there? There's no mention of Washington's role. Actions have consequences. U.S. invasions, occupations, coups, and economic warfare in the Middle East have significantly contributed to turning the region into a disaster area. Washington has aligned itself with feudal despotic regimes. Decades ago, the U.S. identified Middle Eastern oil as crucial to its designs to dominate the world. Fast forward to 2003, the U.S. invasion of Iraq has to be one of the greatest war crimes in history. Its ramifications continue to reverberate throughout the Middle East and beyond. And Palestine? Things are as bleak as ever. Edward Said, internationally renowned Columbia University professor, practically invented the field of post-colonial studies. The New York Times called him one of the most influential literary and cultural critics in the world. As one of the few advocates for Palestinian rights in the United States, he was the target of vilification, death threats, and vandalism. He was a trenchant critic not just of Israeli policies, but also of Arafat, the corrupt coterie around him, and the tyrannical Arab governments. He felt strongly that intellectuals had a special responsibility to speak out against injustice, challenge power, confront hegemonic thinking, and provide alternatives. His memoir, Out of Place, won the New Yorker Book of the Year Award. He and I did two books of interviews, The Pen and the Sword, and Culture and Imperialism. Edward Said died in New York in September 2003. This never-before-broadcast classic from the AR archive was recorded on May 8, 2003, at the University of Washington in Seattle. It was one of his last public talks. And now, Edward Said.
Thank you very much. I'm convinced that during and since the end of the American and British war against Iraq, the word America and its adjective American have been used more times than ever before by everyone. Certainly not a moment goes by without the media proclaiming what America has done and will do, as does the government, as well as all the various spokespersons who purport to speak for all of us as Americans. Along with the word America have gone the pronouns us and ours, used repeatedly for our forces, our plans, our democracy, our values, and so on and on. There's never been a time when the flag has been as much in evidence as now, displayed all the way from jacket lapels to gigantic buildings, and accompanied with the sundry rituals of verbal patriotism, loyalty, and affirmative national identity. I'm going to talk about the American situation today, but not in strictly speaking affirmative and positive ways. We're all Americans here, yes, but what is being done by the official America, does it correspond to what we are and what we want? I shall argue no. And that the whole issue of what America is or says it is very much up for grabs, and certainly as citizens, it's our duty, I think, to enter the fray. I don't have any ready formula for what is America or American, because I shall argue, as I did in my book Orientalism, that identities are very much made or constructed in comparison with other similarly constructed identities, and that the America that we see today in the Middle East, for example, is something that needs to be examined and rediscovered for the formidably complicated and frequently destructive thing that it really is, despite all the festivals of joy and victory that we seem to be celebrating about what happened in Iraq and may happen again elsewhere in the region. My own view is that there are many Americas, and that that very pluralism is precisely what is so unique and precious about this amazing country, its immigrant population, its diversity of races and cultures, its openness to the whole world. I believe all that is now threatened by a narrow, chauvinist view of America that dominates the country by the current Washington administration, threatening our basic freedoms and, most of all, our democracy, as well as threatening the world itself in hectoring, belligerent, moralistic, and intolerant terms and actions. But first, a word or two about history and interpretations of history, interpretations, that is, that depend on the perspective of who speaks, who is being spoken to, and for what reason. And this, far from being an idle academic or intellectual game, is the key to politics. Most of our fellow citizens have an understandably vague idea of what Middle Eastern, and more particularly Arab history, is, and they have only the most general idea of what American policy in the world at large actually is. Certainly the mass media is most unhelpful in this respect. But from the point of view of most Arabs, there are facts that need to be acknowledged and understood before we as Americans presume to make generalizations about democracy and terrorism and politics, not only in the Arab world, but also in this one. As both an American and an Arab, I chafe and indeed become angry when I hear dogmatic statements about Arab violence and American materialism, for example, because both seem to me reductive and simply wrong. Politics is trying to bend history and how to judge and how these judgments impel us to act. This is what politics is. There's an important role, therefore, in political discussions for the role of history and for that of intelligent understanding. Let me try to provide some of that. The Arab world, from the Mediterranean to the eastern borders of Iraq, and I mean by the Mediterranean, I don't mean just the eastern Mediterranean, I'm talking about the whole of North Africa, the Levant, and then to the eastern borders of Iraq, has been ruled by outside powers, that is to say non-Arab powers, continuously since the 16th century. First, it was the Ottomans. Then, after they were defeated in World War I, it was the British and the French. Then, after World War II and the discovery of vast amounts of oil, it was the United States and Israel, which has become a regional superpower with a formidable army and nuclear arsenal, much of it supplied by the United States. There have been independent governments in the region, but all of them, without significant exception, operated in an atmosphere of national emergency. Hence, the distortions and despotisms that have occurred there, one of them, of course, the government of Saddam Hussein. These despotisms and distortions have occurred there as a result, as a reaction to outside powers trying to control the Arab world. And these governments and policies there, it must be added, took place in a general atmosphere of what was called anti-colonial, anti-imperial struggle. The early years of post-war, post-Second World War independence in the Arab world were marked by such outside interventions as the 1956 Suez War, the French War in Algeria, and the effects, of course, of the Cold War. Since 1967, Israel has been in military occupation of the Palestinian territories, and this after the destruction of Palestine, of Arab Palestine, in 1948. The Syrian Golan Heights are still occupied, as until recently were a large part of South Lebanon and the whole of the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula. In the Gulf region, all the countries there operate now as American protectorates. All are oligarchies threatened from the outside for their oil and their strategic position. Today, the United States is in military occupation of one of the largest and most significant Arab countries, Iraq, and shows no sign of leaving there anytime soon. You'll understand from all this that in Arab eyes, there is no real independence here, a situation compounded not only by the new colonial occupation of Iraq by the US, whose government and mass media have conducted also an unremitting onslaught against the Arab people, their culture, and their traditions, but also by the rule of mostly military, unpopular governments, Arab governments, who claim to be in power as a safeguard against further outside intervention. Every Arab will tell you that these are unrepresentative, these Arab governments in place now, are unrepresentative and repressive governments that derive, in the end, from the fate of living in an area which, for all sorts of cultural, geopolitical, religious, and historical reasons, outsiders have had designs on what they feel is their land, their world, their resources, and their fate. Perhaps the essence of what I'm talking about, of this sense of being threatened from the outside, is embodied in a front-page New York Times photograph that shows a swaggering Donald Rumsfeld leaning back expansively in the huge main cabin of what seems to be his personal jumbo jet, en route to Iraq and the Gulf, surrounded by what seem to be dozens of aides, bodyguards, generals, and experts who ring him like courtiers surrounding Caligula in one of his flying imperial palaces. Then, when he arrives in countries like Qatar and Kuwait, he's shown being greeted with abject, welcoming smiles by local potentates in flowing robes, faceless and nameless, but to everyone concerned, are known to rule their little fiefdoms at Rumsfeld's pleasure. He is the conqueror of Iraq, and indeed it would seem of the world. In the background are the string of U.S. military bases from the Gulf to the northern Caspian Sea in about 15 countries, to say nothing also of many, many more bases in dozens of countries elsewhere in the Pacific, European, and northern commands. To an Arab seeing all this, a new outside power has come to change lives there irrevocably. You will appreciate that this is not a pleasing prospect. So in short, I think it's wrong to say that imperialism ended. It didn't, although in fact the British and the French empires may have ended. It continues today in forms that as Americans should make us feel deeply uncomfortable and dissatisfied with the fact that we are following as an empire in the footsteps of all the others. I've spent a lifetime studying empires. Every empire in its official discourse says that it is not an empire, that it's different, and that it has the unique history and power to do things for culture and civilization and democracy that no one has attempted before. Lodged at the very heart of the official American undertaking in the Middle East is the same imperialist thing, except that Bush, Rumsfeld, and the others have a media and many intellectuals who have internalized the official and much reiterated theme of American altruism and beneficence and never question or are bothered by what it is that we do. That is why one is grateful for occasional glimmers of edifying honesty, such as was offered recently by Michael Ledeen, a member of the Pentagon's advisory group and a veteran of the Iran-Contra scandal, now the holder of the Freedom Chair at the American Enterprise Institute. I quote, "Every 10 years or so," he says, "the United States needs to pick up some small, crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show the world we mean business." In fact, however, most of us are lied to and manipulated. Journalists were embedded in military units and saw only what they were allowed to see. Moreover, everything they wrote had to be approved by the Pentagon. That was why the Arab satellite channel Al Jazeera, which I see, I have a satellite dish and I can see it regularly, was many times more informative than CNN, for example, and the panel discussions on Al Jazeera much more interesting, since in the US media, dissent was mostly absent, and ignorant so-called experts were relied on to provide prepackaged cliches about the Arabs and the Iraqis that simply reinforced what had already been decided upon by a small clique within the administration. The case against Iraq as warranting an enormously expensive and destructive war, now estimated at about $80 or $90 billion, was, in my opinion, entirely confected to conceal and disguise the two reasons that wars are usually fought for: material interests and conquest. According to right-wing commentators, George Bush was brave, progressive, and get this word, moral, in invading Iraq. I quote David Brooks on the Nightly News Hour. A less indulgent view sees what George Bush did as having very little to do with Iraqi democracy, as witness the terrible chaos there now and the manifest incompetence and unpreparedness of the U.S. occupation regime in dealing with it, and with the wanton looting and pillaging that continues even now. Besides, who assigned us the role of bringing democracy to Iraq? Every American needs to ask that question. Every American needs to ask that question very seriously. Beyond the self-glorification of our totally self-invented mission, the real reasons for this war were oil and domination. And this is why there's been a convergence between extremist Israeli and U.S. hawkishness. Ask yourself the question, if Iraq had been the world's largest exporter of oranges, would there have been a war? And were it not also the only Arab country that, because of its wealth and the advanced development of its people, might have been a threat to Israel's domination, not its existence, but its domination? Just look at the list of reasons that were so cynically hawked about by Bush and his lackeys, and see how all of them fade into nothing immediately. First of all, no weapons of mass destruction were found on the almost cosmic level that had been claimed before the war. Iraq, and of course, some of the media, I mean, you take Judith Miller of the New York Times, who's there every day to assure us that they're about to discover that they thought they found them, that some defector did it, but then he changed his story and the weapons were not found. She reports this every single day in what is considered the newspaper of record. She's a disgrace to her profession and to the media in general. Another reason, Iraq was portrayed as an imminent threat. This is the phrase I'm quoting directly George Bush, that Iraq is an imminent threat to the security of the United States, 7,000 miles away. Rubbish. As the 20 useless missiles fired incompetently by the Iraqis into the Kuwaiti desert amply testify. Another false claim, Iraq's is a fearsome military machine. Nonsense. The war was over in 3 weeks because, as the media never remembered to mention, Iraq was a country with a population already bled dry by the US and British sanctions, its population decimated by repression and malnutrition, the morale of its people sapped, and the reality of its culture and human actualities completely effaced from public consciousness. The source of this particularly outrageous Orientalist claim was the inbred and opportunistic circle of Iraqi exiles who told their US patron what they wanted to hear, as well as dubious authorities like Bernard Lewis. Now, I want also to say that there's no example in history of democracy, which is undefined in this case, of democracy being brought in on the barrel of a gun, despite the facile analogies made with the cases of Germany and Japan after World War II. The fact is that aside from pillaging and chaos, the US has in fact created two new things in Iraq by invading the country. One, a new, highly militant Islamic movement in Iraq, which it doesn't have the means at all to handle or understand or circumvent. And second, it's created a coalition of U.S.-approved, quite unrepresentative groups, including corrupt exile leaders with no constituency in Iraq, and two Kurdish groups who have a lot of scores to settle with Iraq's Arab majority. So this is the immediate result of our invasion to bring democracy. The same flawed logic applies to the U.S.'s appalling ideas and plans for what it will do now. The U.S. wants the world to pick up the tab for the damages the Bush government has caused. This is why, understand it. They now want the UN there because they want the UN to pay for what they did. And it also wants Iraq to become a happy hunting ground for every rapacious corporation in the book. With a militant anti-Arab, anti-Muslim Likudnik like Paul Bremer now in charge, he's a trustee of the Jewish Institute for National Defense, the prospects for a future country in Iraq look dim indeed. This America is following in Britain's imperial footsteps there. But unlike Britain, we don't have a cadre of colonial administrators. We don't have a core of Middle Eastern hands or Arabists to rely on. All that seem to be present are ideological hawks whose ideas come out of their head and books they've read, and whose ideas are dominated by a virulent pro-Israel and anti-Arab bias, all of it at the expense of the lived experience of actual, real people. It makes you weep. As for the argument that Iraq, I'm still going through the list of arguments for the war, that Iraq had violated UN resolutions. You remember, it's violated the UN resolutions, as George Bush said. Well, it's true, it did violate them. But the violations by Israel and the United States have been far greater. Rich. The ineffable Richard Pearl has delivered himself of the standard American line when he said in The Guardian, shortly after the war ended, that the UN was dead and deserved to die. What didn't occur to him or to anyone else is that the UN was not created to serve the US's imperial vagaries, but exactly the opposite. This was a war universally acknowledged, therefore, to be illegal and immoral. The whole of the world felt that. What a dreadful precedent this has set for the U.S. and for other states who may wish to claim God and good and then intervene militarily against some weak country next to them. The U.N.'s refusal to go along reflected the world majority. No one, not even the American electorate, which was not consulted anyway, has given George Bush, who apparently prays himself into goodness every morning and evening in readiness for battle against evil, no one gave him the right unilaterally with Tony Blair to go to war so brazenly. What I find particularly galling is the condescension in the whole plan, in the way it was described. The assumption that the American people that listened to all the bilge about freeing Iraq was that the way they thought the American people who listened to all that was little more than an assembly of moronic school children, despite the misleading, not to say manipulative, polls that gave Bush such an illusory support for mayhem and rapacity abroad. So it is true, as Tony Judd has brilliantly stated it in the New York Review of Books, the issue of May the 1st, and I quote, that if you want to understand how America appears to the world today, consider the sport utility vehicle. Oversized and overweight, the SUV disdains negotiated agreements to restrict atmospheric pollution. It consumes inordinate quantities of scarce resources to furnish its privileged inhabitants with supererogatory services, which means unneeded services. It exposes outsiders to deadly risk in order to provide for the illusory security of its occupants. In a crowded world, the SUV appears as a dangerous anachronism. Like U.S. foreign policy, the sport utility vehicle comes packaged in sonorous mission statements. But underneath, it is just an oversized pickup truck with too much power. In the Arab world, America is now mainly known for its interest in oil, its disdain for Arabs and Muslims, and its blind, unconditional support for Israel's systematic human rights abuses of the Palestinian people. In all, an intolerable record of extremism, sheer sadistic cruelty, and obdurate willingness to accept the equal existence of another people. It is not at all accidental that the American campaign in Iraq and before it in Afghanistan against world terrorism has been cynically accompanied and exploited by General Sharon, who must have been jolted on a June day last year to have heard himself described by George Bush as a man of peace. In this country, we are all so used to clichés about Israel's democracy and its precarious existence that we're simply unable to see what, behind all the murk and the propaganda about wanting peace, Israel has really been about, with full U.S. backing. The Iraq campaign bears all the marks of Israeli attitudes to the Arabs, from the racist idea that they only understand the language of power, to the arrogance of trying to impose their will upon everyone, to the notion that if they don't fit in the area, then the area has to be changed by military means. Look what Sharon did in Lebanon in 1982, and the 17,000, mostly civilian Palestinians and Lebanese, he was responsible for killing when his armies tried to change the Lebanese regime and failed. Look also at what Israel has always done to the Palestinians. I'll come to that in a minute. But for an honest statement of what Israel is really about, here is the Israeli chief of staff, Moshe Ya'alon, saying that the aim of Israel's policy is to lead the Palestinians, now listen to this, to internalize in the deepest recesses of their consciousness that they are a defeated people. This is Israeli policy stated candidly, and I must say with admirable clarity. Remark that this is not a new policy, but comes on the heel of a long campaign to erase Palestinians from any human or political consideration. Well-meaning liberals who consider that all the problems for Israel began in 1967, people like Susan Sontag, for example, are lulling themselves into an illusion, since the Zionist assault begins in earnest with the destruction of Palestinian society in 1948 and the total dispossession of the Palestinian people, the loss of their land, and their statelessness ever since.
You're listening to Edward Said on U.S. interventions in the Middle East. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program and the book, The Pen and the Sword, by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In a trilogy of powerful books entitled The Land Without People, the Palestinian-Israeli scholar Noor Mazhalha has unearthed both the theory and practice of emptying the land of Israel of its indigenous inhabitants. Much of the pre-state ideology that mobilized Eastern European Jewish communities for the trek to Palestine, which was held by Britain in the first part of the 20th century, was premised on the virtual absence of inhabitants, and the virtual absence of inhabitants on what was often depicted as either a completely empty or a hopelessly arid land awaiting redemption. Later, or in some cases simultaneously with that contention, when the discovery of actual Palestinians could no longer be deferred or denied, there was a concerted effort to devise ways of spiriting them away, for which the War of 1948 provided field commanders and David Ben-Gurion himself a rich opportunity to get rid of Palestinians. This policy is amply attested to in the Israeli military archives, as combed assiduously by a number of Jewish as well as numerous Arab researchers, including Mazhalha himself. Since 1967, the desire to efface and or repress what has remained of Palestinian life in the cities and villages of the West Bank and Gaza has remained an often explicitly Israeli goal, recently hidden inside the polemics of a war for Israel's survival and a defense against terrorism. But whether its new Jewish citizens liked it or not, Israel was always encumbered by Palestinian memory, which is one of the things I'm focusing on here. It's not as if a whole existence of a people can be easily wiped away like a footprint in the sand. The sheer banality of such a possibility is too obvious to require more comment here. What I would like to note is that the power of memory in the Palestinian collective mind has persisted. The more Israel has unilaterally exerted its considerable force to bury the Palestinian past, as it were, there has therefore been a painstaking collective and yet uncoordinated Palestinian memory that has maintained Palestinian history since the disaster of 1948. Palestinian cinema is one result. What has remained of the vastly dispersed fragments of history since 1948 have been painstakingly collected by Palestinians over time as objects of memory. Such things as house keys, title deeds, photographs, letters, embroideries, and so forth, and through film, fiction, poetry, oral discourse, critical and political analysis, significant or traumatic collective experiences like the Deir Yassin, Kfar Qasim, Sabra and Shatila massacres, and the Jenin events of last spring. The significant episodes of Palestinian suffering have been preserved along with the national life that bore and outlived them. I remember writing in 1982, during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, whenever one of us had an opportunity to speak in public, there was a requirement to start narrating the collective national narrative as if from scratch. No freestanding Palestinian story was available that could place before the world the chronological sequence of dispossession and catastrophic loss that has so disfigured and mutilated contemporary Palestinian life. Such a sequence has been interdicted in all sorts of ways, far too many times by such things as the carting off by Israeli soldiers of Palestinian archives in Beirut during the 1982 invasion. And only last year, the Israeli occupation army similarly removed records, computers, hard drives, statistics from Palestinian offices at the Central Bureau of Statistics on the West Bank, the Ministry of Education, and elsewhere in the occupied territories. Whether this was meant to put a stop to Palestinian national life, just short of full ethnic cleansing, I don't want to speculate here. But that such procedures are of a piece with claims that Israel is fighting for its life, and that in occupying and destroying everything possible by tanks, bulldozers, F-16s, and Apache helicopters, which were also used in Iraq by Americans, it is defending itself against terrorists who happen to have no army or viable defense or means of waging war of any description. That seems totally obvious. In any event, the great narrative of Palestinian life hasn't yet been achieved, or for that matter written, any more than the fulfillment of its logical national aspirations have been fulfilled, although it seems just as obvious that there is no regression, no flagging among Palestinians everywhere on that inexorable drive. Despite all this, a Palestinian nation in exile or in waiting has emerged with an unmistakable outline and personality of its own, and it has attracted heroic supporters such as Rachel Corrie to come and join the ranks in solidarity with the struggle for human rights and Palestinian rights in particular. The vast networks of institutions, groups, and collectivity scattered all over the world that sustains the continuity of Palestinian national life is an amazing thing. It has drawn not only on the mobilized energies of Palestinians everywhere, but also on the widespread, the dazzlingly widespread commitment to them of their friends, allies, and comrades all over the world. The obstacles placed before the path of the Palestinians on a daily, minute-by-minute basis cannot be overestimated. Each of them a conscious, willful abuse of human rights collected from literally everywhere in the history of colonial brutality against indigenous people, but now protracted into several different regimes of oppression. Note, please, first, the utter inequality of power between stateless and dispersed Palestinians and the collection of Arab states who offend their humanity, who dehumanize them, but who nevertheless house them. There's a story in yesterday's or today's paper about refugee Palestinians in Iraq who were housed in Iraq where they had no place to go. And today, as a result of the end of the regime of Saddam Hussein, the continuation of the tragedy is so horrible. These same 40,000 Palestinians who were given homes in Iraq because they were kicked out of their own homes are now being kicked out of the homes by Iraqis who say these are their homes. And of course, the Palestinians have no place to go. In countries where Palestinians have been fortunate enough to acquire citizenship, there are invidious laws that discriminate against them as somehow different from the rest of the population. This is sadly true even in the United States. Inside Israel, non-Jewish Palestinians are underrepresented. They are juridically not allowed rights of immigration, land acquisition, or leasing. These rights are automatically accorded the Jewish citizens of the state. Since late 2001, extra pressure on them as a community has been applied, even though they represent over 20% of Israel's population. As for the West Bank and Gaza, the 36-year-old military occupation, now the longest and most brutally sustained in modern history. You don't ever get that on the news. You say Palestinian violence or extremists. But you're not reminded, as you should be every day, that this military occupation has been there for 36 years without a let-up for 1 minute. This has taken a horrific toll in the human condition of the Palestinians on every level. In fact, short of genocide itself, I cannot think of a single one of their human rights as a people that has not been violated with a kind of refined viciousness designed to dehumanize, break their spirit, and humiliate them to a degree that is simply stupefying. What's made it worse is how much of this has been willfully shielded from witnessing eyes by propaganda about fighting for survival against terrorism, claims that in any other instance would defy the credulity of the most gullible intelligence. The sheer inequality between the average Palestinian and the average Israeli is breathtaking, and you're never shown this on television. You will say something disapproving about those terrible suicide bombers, Palestinian suicide bombers, and I will agree. But how many Israelis have had to live through the demolition of their houses, of entire villages, blocks of flats, shopping districts by bulldozers? How many Israelis have had to endure missile attacks by Apache helicopter or rockets from American-made F-16 fighter jets? How many Israelis have to be stripped and searched at checkpoints on an hourly basis, as every Palestinian has to be stripped at checkpoints, 300 checkpoints on the West Bank and Gaza, manned by 17 and 18-year-old Israeli conscripts carrying M16 rifles supplied by us. During the first 3 weeks of the present intifada, 1 million bullets were fired by Israeli military personnel at Palestinians. Neither the Indians demonstrating against the British nor South African blacks fighting against apartheid faced anything like this, nor for that matter did they have to reckon with missiles, hundreds of tanks, helicopters, and F-16 and rocket attacks fired into civilian areas as well as refugee camps that have no defenses and no arms whatever. Consider that on the internet, I picked this date from the recent past, for January 23rd, one can read, for example, 836 Muslim pilgrims, Palestinian pilgrims, to Mecca from Gaza were denied permission to leave. The Catholic cardinal, Palestinian, was detained at Tel Aviv airport and not allowed to leave. Some towns on the West Bank have already sustained 240 days of 24-hour curfew. What the U.S. press has never done is to keep a daily tabulation of how many Palestinians are killed every single day Israelis and Palestinians. No civilians should be killed. But you'll see the vast preponderance of the death of Palestinian deaths. And they are all induced by military means. And many of them are children. Many of them are women who are sick. And many of them are ambulance drivers, journalists, volunteers like Rachel Corey, killed by the Israeli occupation forces. In varying degrees of severity and brutality, this sort of thing has been going on there every day for 36 years. As in the meantime, dozens and dozens of new settlements have been set up on Palestinian land. Conversely, how many Palestinian settlements have infringed on Israeli property? None. How many daily armed incursions, sometimes with 60 tanks, how many Palestinian tanks have penetrated Israeli towns and villages? How many Israeli fields have been burned? None. With all the ritual and fuss surrounding the planting of trees in Israel, does anyone bother to recall that an average of 896 Palestinian trees per day have been uprooted by Israeli settlers and soldiers since the beginning of the Intifada in October 2000. For this kind of continual brutalizing assault, the United States and Israel designed a peace process that lasted 10 years, which was not even supposed to put a stop to all this, but rather to make it seem slightly less unbearable. Yes, a peace process requiring thousands of hours of negotiations to make Israel stop, which of course it didn't at all. And now the roadmap comes in to do more of the same, cover up what is actually going on in the territories. And the most galling thing is today in the New York Times, Dennis Ross, who has returned to his position as an employee of the Israeli lobby in Washington, the man who was put in charge of, quote, the peace process, is pontificating again about how the Arabs have to do this and the Arabs have to do that in order to take advantage of Israel's generous offers. I mean, how galling can you get? You have to use your memory to keep in mind that since the current Intifada began and Mr. Ross began his work in the Clinton administration as trying to continue it into this one, representations of all this have been available on the international, that have been available on the international media simply do not render anything like the harsh awfulness of what life is for a Palestinian on a daily basis in Gaza and the West Bank. The efforts of Israel's spin doctors, the U.S. government and media in conjunction with a weak Arab communications operation have usually combined to make Israel's broad version of events prevail. These continue to give the impression of a struggle between equal forces, a beleaguered and misunderstood Israel occasionally forced into excessive measures to clamp down on terror versus hordes of recalcitrant Palestinians careless of Western value and endemically suicidal for obscure religious reasons. Making the astonishing illegality and inhumanity of Israel's policy, which many Israelis have objected to, many more than Americans, even more difficult to recall this policy and see, not only for outsiders, so to speak, but even for Israelis themselves, is that, as Amira Haas writes in Haaretz, she's a wonderful Israeli correspondent who has lived first in Gaza and then on the West Bank. She writes much more critically of Israel than any American journalist has ever done in the mainstream media. She writes for Haaretz, which is the Israeli New York Times. I mean, that may not be a great compliment, but... I quote her, a person, she says, could travel the length and breadth of the West Bank without ever knowing not only the names of the villages and cities whose lands were confiscated to build the Jewish settlements and neighborhoods, but even the fact that they exist. Most of their names cannot be found on the road signs. And from a distance, the calls of the muezzins and the streets empty of people seem like an aesthetic decoration. A Jew traveling on the almost empty roads of the West Bank would think that there were no longer any Arabs. They do not travel. They are not allowed to travel. And I'm quoting her. They do not travel. They're not allowed to travel on the wide roads used by Jews. End of quote. Both Ehud Parak and now Ariel Sharon have pressed ahead with the building of a fantastically expensive wall, 25 feet high and 12 feet across, or 8 feet across, running the entire length of the West Bank from the north to the south, almost 250 miles, at a cost, obviously, that we're going to pay as taxpayers, which, quite apart from destroying more Arab land and separating towns from their farm acreage on a vast scale, is designed to blot out the existence of Palestinians. This tremendous assault on dignity, on memory, on reality, is quite without precedent or analogy in our postmodern times. By contrast, however, I'd want to remark that all these efforts have not achieved their goal. In every possible way, the diverse actualities of Palestinian identity, far from being a negative or passive thing, have grown first and foremost a culture of human rights and democratic process. We don't need to get it from the United States. It's at the grassroots level that has included a sensitive register of the claims of memory, the demand for attention and justice, despite the world's indifference, and a healthy awareness of the ironies of unequal power. The other fact I'd like to note before closing is that even though in the US and parts of Western Europe, the notion of Palestine is associated invidiously with the idea of violence and terror, there is, as I said earlier, a serious contradiction to that association between Palestinians and violence in an ongoing and recognized Palestinian national life with a quite peculiar, if not outright, tenacity to it that has simply overcome all the terrible ordeals placed in its way. There is today a Palestinian literature, a Palestinian legal, political, and scholarly discourse, a Palestinian cinema, a Palestinian theater, a Palestinian oral tradition, a large number of Palestinian grassroots and political organizations all over the world. In short, a Palestinian style that invigorates and informs all aspects of this far-flung community's existence. There was a coherent Palestinian national life well before Zionism appeared in Palestine. Palestinians sent representatives to the Ottoman Parliament in 1876, before Herzl had written his book about Zionism. The universality of the drive for Palestinian self-determination has acquired now an unbudgeable place in the world's, but not the American, agenda for liberation and resistance. Every major UN conference for the past two decades, women, the environment, racism, human rights, disarmament, health, human development, has had an important place in it for the question of Palestine. Paradoxical though it may seem, the Davos meetings for governmental and corporate leaders has an important component of its agenda devoted to Palestine, while at the other end of the world, in Porto Alegre in Brazil, at the anti-globalization meetings, the presence of a large contingent, Palestinian contingent, is featured, whose presence assures an additional progressive dimension to the debates there. Any discussion of Middle East peace turns out inevitably to be mainly about the question of Palestine. But and I think the world majority is in favor of Palestinian self-determination. It's only a group of extremist hawks in Washington and in Tel Aviv who resist it. If in the period after 1948 Israel had the status of a progressive cause, it is now Palestine that has taken that place. One needs only think of the support Israel in the post-war period had from such people as Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir to gauge how far from that position it has today fallen. As some of its local homegrown critics like Amos Elon and Avishai Margalit have noted, sadly, since the first Intifada of 1987, Israel has been transformed dramatically the world over into a symbol of oppression and injustice, lumped together with the US, and this is really the theme of my talk, for its imperial arrogance, its supremacist attitudes, and for its inhumane policies towards the Palestinians over which it has ruled for so long. And very important has always been the presence of an increasing number of Israelis fighting their own government's policies in favor of Palestinian human rights. Problematic and humanly a very compelling issue, the challenge posed to conscience and consciousness by the Palestinian people raises a whole raft of questions about the post-Cold War political order that are quite unique in their density and difficulty. Contentious and noisy, though some of these issues may be, I want to bring this lecture to a close by looking just very quickly, or noting a few of them, as dispassionately as I can now that the so-called roadmap has been released. The first, for us as Americans, is actually quite simple, but has been clouded over by an enormous amount of cant and euphemism, not only by neocons, but a whole slew of liberal commentators who have spoken favorably about imperialism in general, and American imperialism in particular. There's no doubt that the United States has behaved as an imperial power, as has Israel as a sub-imperial power, mainly because no one seems capable of stopping them, except, of course, for their own citizens, us as Americans, Israelis, as the citizens of their government. What we all saw in Iraq is, or ought to be, compellingly repugnant to us as a people whose republic was born out of the desire to be free of the imperialist rule of an earlier power. For us to go around the world imposing our will militarily, or having it imposed by people who do not, in the final analysis, represent values of independence, but rather those of hawks, business executives, who are cynically ignorant contempt for other people, and see imperial situations like that of Iraq as an opportunity to land lucrative contracts, and ideological pundits who have convinced themselves that the U.S. abroad represents altruism. This is the craziest idea I've ever heard. All of this is a major disaster for our country. Think of the vast amounts of money, the hundreds of billions of dollars wasted on imperial exploits, money which could far more profitably be used here for schools, for universal health coverage, it's so embarrassing as an American to be asked, how come you don't have it? I mean, every country in the world does, except here, because it says, we're told it's socialism, whatever that's supposed to mean. So I think this money, you know, $120 billion is now what they're estimating for Iraq just in the next few months, could be used for schools, hospital, and housing for the immense number of needy people in the United States. Second, imperialism always brings untold suffering on the colonized. And it breeds feelings of hatred and vengeance much greater than any of the rewards offered by such Panglossian projects as building democracy for others. Third, imperialism encourages the worst instincts, including racial hatred, national identities dedicated to the extermination or subordination of others, and economic greed, to say nothing of instilling in the imperialists all sorts of illusions about his power and his ideas, including the even maniacal notion that people hate America because they're jealous of us. We have an almost awakened citizenry in this country, but we must become aware of the fact that whether we like it or not, the world is too small a place either to hide in the vast American hinterland or look away from what is being done in our name. We must no longer turn away from the world we have been a part of ever since the Republic was born over two centuries ago. The obligations of citizenship enjoin upon each American the duty not to pretend not to know when cruelty is visited on others in our name and with our support. The obligations of citizenship require us, therefore, to take back our ideals and become, once again, a secular republic rather than a faith-based empire. An empire that wreaks havoc, punishment, and devastation where we have gone, all in the name of what, in fact, is the oldest of all military doctrines, to divide, to plunder, and to rule. I, for one, reject that, as I'm sure most of you here also do. Thank you.
That was Edward Said on U.S. interventions in the Middle East. This classic from the AR archives was recorded on May 8, 2003, at the University of Washington in Seattle. Edward Said, internationally renowned Columbia University professor, practically invented the field of postcolonial studies. The New York Times called him one of the most influential literary and cultural critics in the world. He passed away in September 2003. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're independent and part of the nonprofit Rise Up. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices from Chris Hedges to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And we have an extensive archive of programs featuring Edward Said. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Edward Said on U.S. Interventions in the Middle East, and the book, The Pen and the Sword, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977, or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. A special shout-out to listeners at WSKG, our affiliate in Binghamton, New York. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.